I'm Jimmy Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. I'm sure you've noticed Cuba has been in the news a lot lately, first with the 50th anniversary of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion last week, and then with the surprise announcement this week by former Cuban leader Fidel Castro that he would formally step down as the head of the Cuban Communist Party there. And just yesterday, the U.S. government published new rules for travel to Cuba. There is a new book about the Bay of Pigs, its legacy, and the implications of that moment in history for American foreign policy. It's called The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs. The author is Jim Rasenberger, and he joins me now in our New York studios. Jim, welcome.
Great to be here.
Jim, most Americans have heard of the Bay of Pigs, and most even know it was something that didn't go quite right. Mm-hmm. But if you ask what the Bay of Pigs actually was, many folks stare back blankly, or they might tell you about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
I get that a lot, yes.
Now, generationally, our listening audience, many people remember it, or even our younger listeners are very well informed. But for the rest of the country, it's kind of buried deep in the recesses of the national memory. So I'm going to ask you in just a moment why you think it's important for us to remember the Bay of Pigs and understand it. But first, in a nutshell, what was the Bay of Pigs and why the national negative connotation?
Yeah, when we talk about the Bay of Pigs, we're talking about a five-day event that occurred in April of 1961. It began on April 15th when some eight B-26 bombers flown by Cuban exile pilots who had been trained by the CIA flew to Cuba from Central America and bombed airfields. They were trying to destroy Fidel Castro's Air Force. Well, that was the opening salvo. 2 days later, the invasion itself occurred on the early morning hours of April 17th when about 1,400 Cuban exiles unloaded from ships and landed on the beaches around the Bay of Pigs. And the plan was to establish a beachhead, hope for uprisings among the populace there, and eventually overthrow Fidel Castro. Well, of course, it didn't work out that way. Within 2 days, the invasion had been defeated, and the brigade was scattering into the swamps, and Fidel Castro's forces were after them to capture them.
Now, it's important for our conversation that's about to happen to understand that this was an effort at regime change, right?
That's right. The United States government had, this is only a couple years after Fidel Castro had come to power, but the United States government had decided that he was a communist and he had to be removed. So they thought the best way to do it would be to use Cuban exiles who were anti-Castro to do this. Some of these guys had been trained in American military academies. A lot of them had been in the Cuban army before. So this seemed like a reasonable plan to some people.
And our listeners will be very annoyed with me if mm-hmm. we don't make the Eisenhower-Kennedy clarification. Mm-hmm. This started in the Eisenhower administration, but this happened under Kennedy's watch.
That's right. We can't forget that Eisenhower had the plan for a year. Kennedy had it for just 3 months. But of course, it was Kennedy who pulled the trigger. And later, Eisenhower, after the invasion failed, Kennedy invited Eisenhower to Camp David, hoping for some solace. And Eisenhower really took him to the woodshed and said, if you're going to do something like this, you have to make sure it succeeds. Eisenhower tried to sort of back out of having any responsibility or blame for this. I think he deserves some. He did have it for a year.
Now, the book highlights the theme that still resonates today, and I'm going to quote you, because you say it in the book better than I ever could. Quote, "The complicated, even schizophrenic relationship in the U.S. between the principles of a free society and the existence of a federal agency devoted to secrecy, namely the CIA." Mm-hmm. And so there's a real dichotomy built into the structure of at least a part of our federal government structure.
That's right. You know, as Americans, we want the benefits of covert operations. Certainly Eisenhower and Kennedy did. And one reason they wanted that is they were trying to avoid nuclear war. So the idea was that if you could go in covertly, not send an overt military force, you could get the same results but for a lot less cost and a lot less risk. But of course, in America, we also believe in a free society. And the idea that we are running these secret operations, that the government is lying to its own people, is very offensive to us.
Explain the title of the book. It's an oxymoron.
It is an oxymoron.
Disaster.
Yes. Well, the brilliance refers to the men who, in Kennedy's administration, the so-called best and brightest, in David Halberstam's famous phrase, who brought this to fruition and who okayed it. One of the amazing things about the Bay of Pigs is Kennedy was surrounded. I mean, he himself was a very bright man and was surrounded by extraordinary people like McGeorge Bundy, William McNamara, by Dean Rusk. All these guys were young, extraordinarily intelligent people. So the question naturally arises, how did they approve it? Well, one theory that I have is that maybe they were too smart. You know, maybe it's when you have people who are so smart and so used to success, it's hard for them to imagine failure. And when they got together in a room, they'd look at each other and think, well, of course this thing's going to work. They trusted each other. And that's one of the mistakes that they made.
As we mentioned, the Treasury Department has published new rules just yesterday after years of restrictions that will allow students, journalists, members of religious organizations to travel to Cuba freely without first asking the U.S. government for permission. So we want to ask our listeners, now that the new rules are in place, will you be going? Do you have any interest in seeing Cuba now that it's easier to travel there? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. This is WNYC 93.9 FM, 820 AM. My guest is Jim Rasenberger, author of Brilliant Disaster. And you went to Cuba in researching this book. What did you observe?
I went exactly a year ago. I went on the 49th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs. And what you see is a country that's still very much frozen in the past, although it is also crumbling before your very eyes. I mean, the infrastructure is in very sorry shape. But they're all around Havana, and then down by the Bay of Pigs are large billboards trumpeting the victory at Playa Girón. That's what they call it. That was the beach where the victory occurred. The first victory against imperialism in Latin America is how they refer to it. They're still very much living in the past. Everybody there, I spoke to a number of people, taxi drivers, people who just walking around. Everybody there knows about the Bay of Pigs. They take it. It's a very important part of their history, almost what July 4th is to us as Americans. And they have, of course, just had an enormous celebration around this 50th anniversary of the Bay of Pigs.
So, as you say, 50th anniversary, considering all that has happened since 1961, why should we here in the United States pay any attention to the Bay of Pigs? Why should it still demand our attention?
It's a good question because, of course, it only lasted 5 days, as I said. It cost just $46 million. I don't think you could make a movie for $46 million, certainly not about the Bay of Pigs invasion. But as I point out in the book, it really was the beginning of a new era in America. I mean, first of all, an era of these troubled interventions. We've been in, according to one count, about two dozen since, not including our 21st century forays into Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. But it also was marked the beginning of an attitude among Americans where they began to distrust their government. The government had lied, and then the government, even worse perhaps, had failed. Arthur Schlesinger had a great quote. This is an aide of Kennedy's that he wrote in his journal afterwards. We not only look like imperialists, we look like ineffectual imperialists, which is worse, and we look like stupid ineffectual imperialists, which is worst of all. And that was true, and it changed the way people thought about their own government. I sort of think of it as the beginning of the Vietnam era, even before the Vietnam War began.
Well, there was Vietnam, and as you say, two dozen. Now, are we talking covert? Overt?
Covert and overt, but involving some form of American force.
So what lessons are learned, if any? None?
Well, I think the first lesson is that we do not learn the lessons of history very well.
Right.
But one lesson we should take away from it is we should not assume that when we go into a foreign country that that the local population is going to come to our support. We assume that in the Bay of Pigs, the CIA was sure there would be uprisings within the country. We assumed it again in Iraq. Didn't turn out quite the way that we planned. That's certainly a very important lesson. Another lesson is that Don't assume things are going to turn out the way we plan them. Murphy's Law is always in effect in these interventions, which is why so many of them go wrong. You know, we've been in all of these interventions, and the great majority in the end don't turn out the way we want them to turn out. I would say one last thing is that we should not base our foreign policy on fear. I think we made that mistake with the Bay of Pigs. Our fear of communism is what drove us to it. You could argue that our fear of terrorism is what drove us into Iraq. And the problem with fear is that it's not a rational way to decide foreign policy.
Let's take a call. Let's take Kim from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Kim, you're on with Jim Rassenberger.
Oh, hi. I was just saying that I'd love to be able to go to Cuba now. I hope that under the new rules, I'll be able to.
And did you ever or often wonder why you couldn't before?
Absolutely. I thought it was totally ridiculous that this was our government's policy. What are we so afraid of?
Ah, what are we so afraid of? Well, Jim, maybe you can help to explain the psychology that was when we invaded, or I guess started to and then abruptly stopped, aborted the invasion in 1961. And your language when trying to describe that in the book is quite compelling. So I do recommend that people read it. But I think you use the word that young people, especially Gen Xers and younger, would think that those who were alive at that time were somewhat hysterical about the threat of communism, especially the creep of it across the globe.
It's hard for us to understand it now, the incredible fear people had. You have to remember just in 1949, so this is 12 years before the Bay of Pigs, China went to the communists and the Soviets exploded a nuclear bomb. That combination of communism seeming to spread inexorably and the fact that it was armed with nukes was terrifying to Americans. So this was considered to be an existential challenge.
Existential, that's the word.
Stopping,
yes.
It really was. That if we did not stop communism, life in America would be threatened. So, of course, the notion that there would be a communist dictator 90 miles off American shores was something that nobody could stomach. Now, it is odd when you go to Cuba and you still get a sense of almost sort of a flashback to 1961. I mean, the Cubans themselves are still sort of living in a relationship with the United States. It feels very like 1961. They still think of the United States as this great imperial power that's trying to cause them damage. But it is an odd thing. Why are we still living in the past? Why our relations are really frozen in exactly the spot that they were 50 years ago.
Yeah, and as you point out, the effort continued to unseat Castro, and yet he remained president until 2008.
Through 10 presidents, 11 if you include U.S. Obama.
U.S. presidents.
Yes, and that would be, that's a quarter of all American presidents.
Yes. Let's take a call from Nora in New Jersey. Nora, thank you so much for your call. You're on with Jim Rassenberger, and you have, I believe, been to Cuba.
Yes, and how are you? Hello. Yes, I went to Cuba. I'm an American citizen, but with no ethnic or cultural ties to Cuba. But I went there in 2001 simply because I went there to connect with friends who came in from Italy. And it was a terrific experience. I'm glad that I went. And I think that the whole thing, the whole Cuban embargo thing, is just a reflection of the hysteria that you were just talking about, of how fearful people really were back in the 50s and 60s, which I certainly remember, and I was afraid too, but the reality is something quite different.
It was half a century ago.
That's right.
Did you, Nora, have to make an application to the government to be able to go?
I didn't do any of that.
Oh, dear.
You may not want to admit that on air.
Yeah, I just felt that it was kind of silly. So I flew to Toronto.
Ah, so you went through Canada.
And I went in through Canada, and there was no questions asked. No, of course, you can't use any credit cards there, or everything was in American dollars, which, of course, they desperately needed.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for your call
for
your candor.
Of course. Anytime.
Now, you talked, Jim, about Cold War theory and the psychology of that. There are some who draw the parallel between Cold War theory and psychology and the politics surrounding the so-called War on Terror. Do you think that goes too far?
No, I think there are a lot of similarities. In both cases, fear, as I mentioned before, fear is what drove foreign policy. And I think we could argue in both cases that we got ourselves into some sticky situations because we weren't thinking these things through rationally. I mean, go back to Castro. We just said Castro stayed in power through 10 presidents, American presidents. Well, what does that show? It shows that he really was not an existential threat. And very few people at the time realized it, but one senator, William Fulbright, said to Kennedy before the invasion, trying to encourage him not to go in, Castro is a thorn in the side. He's not a dagger in the heart. And, of course, Fulbright turned out to be right.
Let's talk. You mentioned 26 military actions, not including Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Let's talk about Libya, very much in the news today. Cuba, of course, not Libya, but it does seem that we have a White House that wants to come up with some sort of low-cost regime change plan, whatever they may say publicly, that would topple Gaddafi without bogging us down in an inconclusive foreign war without boots on the ground. It does sound disturbingly similar to Cuba in 1961.
It does. I guess, you know, the difference would be that in the case of Libya, we were invited in by the Libyan people, which is, I think, it's an important distinction. It doesn't solve the problem of how we're going to get out. I mean, I think in every one of these interventions, we always discover it's a lot easier to go in than it is to get out.
Well, is there any good way to overthrow the government of a sovereign nation? And I guess I'm quoting you.
Yeah, I think history's pretty clear on that. There really isn't. And we have been, as Americans, struggling to find a way to assert American power and do it in a way that is both true to what we profess to be our moral nature. We like to think of ourselves as a country run on morals. But at the same time, get what we want. You know, they're kind of incompatible goals. And we've tried many different ways. Covert action was big in the 1960s. The CIA played around with assassination was another way to try to do it. You know, now that we step away from covert activity, we're left with a situation that Kennedy was trying to avoid, putting overt force, American force, into another country. Well, once you put American force into another country, then the stakes are quite high because you can't lose. And it's very easy to get out. I mean, it's very difficult to get out. So now we're in a situation in Libya where we can't simply walk away and say, well, that didn't work out too well. Now, for America's reputation, it kind of has to work out. So it's an even trickier situation in a way than what Kennedy faced in Cuba.
And as Eisenhower scolded.
And as Eisenhower
when he met
scolded.
With Kennedy
That's
thereafter.
Right.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC Radio. My guest is Jim Ratzenberger, whose new book is The Brilliant Disaster. The anniversary of the Bay of Pigs was on the 17th of this month, and we noted it on our political website, itsafreecountry.org. Listeners can go there for my humble blog, but I did mention your book, Jim, in my blog.
Thank you.
But I got some comments. Uh-huh. Mike wrote, quote, "While I agree America would be better served attending to its own house, certain forces in the world make military action both inevitable and necessary. People who believe war is never an option under any circumstances are simply naive. Certain forces in the world make it necessary. Until recently, Gaddafi had been a non-entity due in large measure to President Reagan ordering an F-14 to fly around the skies of Tripoli." And then he finishes, "I don't want to be the policeman of the world, but if not us, who? And if no one, what would be the result?" And it reminded me, of course, of the early part of the book where you talk about America's place post-World War II and sort of the position we have been in ever since then as the lead, as, quote, the leader of the free world. And so that's really the question. If not us, who? In Libya, in the Middle East, in the Far East, indeed anywhere, one could have said in Rwanda.
Yeah.
And certainly there is a lesson to be learned from the Bay of Pigs, but the lesson may not be a non-interventionist lesson. It may be force early and unfortunately often.
Well, I don't really know what the answer is. And certainly I don't disagree with the idea that we have to go in sometimes. Of course we do. But we should always go in knowing that things could turn out very badly. And we should never, you know, I think the one of the problems with going into Libya, for example, is Obama assured us that we would be there very briefly and that it would be a rather painless intervention. And they never are. That's really the lesson. They're never painless, and they're always hard to get out of. So we have to choose very, very carefully.
All right, we're going to take one last call. Nick in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi, how are you? I actually went to Cuba. I was there during September 11th, and I was at the Bay of Pigs. And it's really gorgeous. It's a nice, quiet town. But I stood in front of the sign that said, this is the site where we defeated the Yankee imperialists. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was like a double-edged sword because, yeah, it's like, you know, we don't really have business meddling with other people's affairs. And, you know, on the other hand, it's like I didn't know about September 11th for, you know, 3 days after the fact until I was in the airport, you know. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's the dichotomy of their country, kind of. But also, you know, it just goes to show you that my opinion basically is that you shouldn't go in all sneaky peeky with a few people and try and take out a government. If you're going to do it, you got to do it with their full army so people know about it. I mean, it's kind of the thing in Libya. I feel like people in Libya are going to be kind of stuck out because they don't have guns and ammunition to back him up. You know, we could shoot down their forces, but until people really have the force to take over their government, they're not going to be able to do it, you know.
Thank you. So thank you, like, for thank you for your call. I'm tight on time. Let me get a final comment from you, Jim, and let me add a question to it. It is interesting that you write the book and you say that time and again we seem to repeat some of the mistakes, you know, the old and oft-quoted, perhaps too often, phrase that if you don't know your history, you're destined to repeat it. But yet you write the book with a hopeful note. So then the question is, why write the book? Clearly, you think there are some lessons that we will and can learn. And so what is the hope in writing the book?
Well, of course, I guess my fond hope as an author is that people read it and do learn the lessons. But look, we learn history slowly. Over time, certain lessons do take. I was being facetious earlier when I said the first lesson is we don't learn the lesson. We do obviously learn some of the lessons. You know, the trick is going back to the caller's point of how to apply American force and that we shouldn't go in, I think his phrase was sneaky peeky. The problem is if you don't go in sneaky peeky, then you go in overtly and you raise a whole other set of issues. You have to recall, I mean, you have to have some sympathy for why Eisenhower and then Kennedy wanted to go in covertly, which is that they were very concerned about starting up some sort of uncontrollable conflagration with the Soviet Union. That was always a very, very serious concern in the late 50s and early 1960s. And if the United States had gone in with the Marines into Cuba to get rid of Castro, Khrushchev would have had to respond in kind, probably in West Berlin, which he'd been threatening to cut off from the West. And then the United States would have had to respond, and so on. You would have gotten into this game of escalation. By going in covertly, the idea was that you could lower the stakes and just keep the damage down to a minimum.
Hmm. Well, lessons learned and lessons yet to be learned. And we begin with your book, The Brilliant Disaster. Jim Rasberger, thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, more lessons, this time on women in combat. Stay with us.